Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This episode of the FX Podcast is brought to you by Side Effects Software, makers of Houdini, a faster, easier, and more productive workflow, giving artists more control in their day-to-day work. Find out more from the Side Effects Software website, sidefx.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. The FX Podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. This podcast is your opportunity to hear directly from the source, from the front lines of visual effects. Be sure to check out our other podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. Well, I'm very excited for this episode. Mike Seymour speaking with Carl Rosendahl. Carl is currently on the faculty at Carnegie Mellon University's Entertainment Technology Center. But he started Pacific Data Images, PDI, in 1980, which led to a partnership with DreamWorks SKG. He sold PDI to DreamWorks in 2000. He's been a venture capitalist and very active with organizations like the Visual Effects Society. In fact, one of the reasons Mike wanted to talk with Carl was that at the Visual Effects Society annual members meeting, Carl was presented with the Founders Award and gave a very strong speech where he spoke passionately about the future of the visual effects business, framing it more as the beginning of the industry as opposed to the normal doom and gloom we hear. Here's a couple of quotes from the speech.
But the issues I hear about are outsourcing, tax incentives, global competition, unfair business practices, runaway production, trade organizations, unions, ownership, piracy, the race to the bottom. It's really important stuff. I understand that. I've run a business. There's no solution, but there are opportunities there. If you think a trade organization is going to solve your problems, please get off your ass and make one. Start small, pick an easy problem, and fix it. Grow from there into bigger, harder problems. A level playing field won't solve all the problems. You can't legislate or otherwise keep people from willingly losing money. Getting participation in movies won't be free. You have to put skin in the game, and in Hollywood, that skin is called cash. Globalization, it's here to stay. Deal with it. Diversification gives you a broader sense of business. You can invest in change that way without even having to go all in. But there's not enough movie work to go around. It's simple supply and demand. You can't limit the supply of companies willing to do the work. In fact, that's growing. You need to create demand for something that you can do better than anyone else. And not just better, but you have to be unique. Because the only way you're going to convince your customers that you're not a commodity is by being able to offer them something no one else can. If you're offering the same product with the same terms, then as far as they're concerned, you are a commodity. And you have to be different in order to be able to compete.
If you are a VES member, you can view video of the speech online at the Visual Effects Society site. And we'll have a copy of the transcript right here on the site at the link where you found this podcast on fxguide.com. Anyway, there's a lot of great stuff in this speech, and Carl elaborates a lot more with us in this chat, which I want to take you to now. Mike Seymour speaking with Carl Rosendahl.
So let's start with where you are today. You're a professor at Carnegie Mellon, and in particular in the area of entertainment technology. Could you explain that for us?
Yeah, Carnegie Mellon has a great master's program called the Entertainment Technology Center. It's a two-year master's degree focusing on specifically that, entertainment technology. There's about, I think, 160 to 180 students in the two-year program. And it's four semesters. Your first semester, you take a core curriculum, and then your other three semesters are really project-based. And we have the benefit of having a satellite campus out here in the Bay Area in California, embedded inside of Electronic Arts, the game company. And they give us space, and we get about 15 to 20 students each semester who come out and work on projects primarily. We have a couple of elective classes they can take, but there are two of us who are faculty members out here. We work with those students and spend most of our time mentoring and advising them through the process of their projects.
So that program, is it just at a master's level? Does it go further into a PhD level? Or
no, it's just a master's program.
So prior to that or concurrently with that, venture capital, are you still active in the venture capital community?
No, I did that for about 3 years after I left PDI. So I left PDI in early 2000. So that was, if you recall, the peak of the internet bubble. And I was with a group called Mobius Venture Capital at the time, here in Silicon Valley for just shy of 3 years.
So what was the sort of businesses that, and this will become, I guess, even more relevant when we start to expand our discussion, but what sort of businesses were you interested in and what did you learn from investing in other people's startups?
Wow, it was a huge education. My focus was particularly on entertainment technology related companies. So venture capitalists, by their nature, don't invest in content typically. So it was the underlying technologies to enable content online. The internet was, I want to say the next new thing at that point. The internet had been alive for, 4 or 5 years? Then things were really taking off. There was a lot of speculation about where things would go. But ultimately, for the kinds of things that I was interested in, I think it was a little early. The technology for really making high-quality content available online wasn't there yet, and the kinds of opportunities that were interesting to invest in were few and far between, on top of which the bubble burst right in 2000. So a lot of what was going on during my tenure in the VC world was dealing with problems rather than forward-looking, wonderful new things.
Right. So why was it, I mean, well, not perhaps why was it, but what was the sort of moment at which you decided to leave PDI? Was that something that was a long time coming or did an opportunity present itself?
No, so it was kind of an evolution. I know you had a great conversation with Richard. I listened to it again today in preparing. It was just wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I started PDI in 1980. I left at the beginning of 2000. So it was about a 20-year run. And the goal from early on was to eventually get to the point where we could do fully computer animated feature films. And we set that goal in around 1984 or so. And we started out in broadcast graphics, moved into commercial, then feature film effects, and finally got our chance to do feature films. And it's funny when you set a goal like that, you finally reach it because you think that, wow, it's going to be wonderful. I'm finally getting to do what has taken so long to do. And what I discovered was the part I really enjoyed was figuring out how we were going to get there and take that next step. So getting us into broadcast graphics, doing the migration into becoming a provider for commercials and then visual effects and then finally doing the deal with DreamWorks. I always loved looking forward to that next step and the next opportunity. And once we were finally producing films, that was kind of the end of the road. And the internet was taking off. There were all sorts of interesting new opportunities and directions and things to do. But it was really clear that the near-term future for PDI with DreamWorks was going to be creating films. And so I really felt like, even though I was where I wanted to be, that suddenly I felt that for me personally, I was stagnating, that my job had really become almost more of a figurehead than getting to be the planner and visionary that I am.
Was there also an element of it that you'd found a really good place for PDI to be? You'd found a good home for it where it was in a supportive, structured environment, so you sort of felt comfortable leaving?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the goal forever had been to get to a point where we could create fully computer animated films. And we knew early on that we were going to have to partner with a studio to do that. We didn't have the financial wherewithal to try and fund anything like that ourselves. So we knew we had to partner with a company. DreamWorks was a fantastic opportunity for us. It was incredible working with Jeffrey and his team. You know, he's one of the few people in Hollywood, particularly at that time, who got it, who understood computer graphics. You know, we went around and visited every studio in Hollywood over the course of probably 3 years trying to convince them to make films. And we had projects that we had developed and such. It was easy to get a meeting, easy to get FaceTime with people because they were all curious. But at the end of the day, no one was willing to take the risk other than Jeffrey. And he had done that at Disney with Pixar and was clearly willing to do that again at DreamWorks. So it was an ideal marriage for us, one that enabled us to do what we wanted to do and give them the power to take DreamWorks in directions that they want it to go. So, it was a perfect match.
It should be pointed out that before that DreamWorks deal with Jeffrey Katzenberg, you had no Steve Jobs, you had no George Lucas. And as I discussed with Richard in that separate interview and podcast, I think one of the remarkable successes of PDI was your business success in maintaining a creatively valid, relevant, and expanding company over, you know, such a long period of time when so many other companies failed.
Yeah, it was hard, but fun. I think part of that, I think there's a lot of contributing factors, but part of it was, as you know, my father funded us early on, but the underlying idea of that was that we would become self-sufficient very quickly, which we did. We paid him back within a few years, and our survival depended on being profitable. So it's a very old school kind of financial model of, oh, if you want to survive, you need to actually make a profit. So we had to be super conservative and smart about everything we did. And that kept getting beat into us all the time. And it wasn't always easy. We went through a lot of difficult times. We had to do rounds of layoffs occasionally when things got really bad. But we tried to be smart about how we invested our money. We were really open with the employees. I think we built an incredible culture around that. And it was really I think having the long-term vision of where we wanted to go motivated us through all the difficult times to really figure out how to do it and survive.
And there's one other thing I want to touch on here, because this is going to be relevant as we move to that speech you gave to the VS, which is, and I take nothing away from Pixar, a company I admire tremendously, but mm-hmm. Pixar literally got tens of millions of dollars worth of funding out of a combination of what happened initially with George Lucas, then, of course, with Steve Jobs. But more to the point, they never had to sort of effectively change the company the way you did. I mean, we discussed with Richard, there's this period where you were just completely known for network, what we would now perhaps disparagingly call logo flips. But at the time, this was the cutting edge of computer graphics. This was really the point, the sharp pointy end of all the research that was being done in a commercial sense. And then mm-hmm. again, you changed for commercials, and again, you changed for visual effects and for feature films. And I think this is important, because I'm going to get to this when we speak about the industry in general, but you really, as a team and as the head of that team, managed several iterations. PDI was never really just one thing. It was a growing, evolving company.
Right, right.
So with that in mind, I'd love to turn our attention, if we could, to your views on the industry and reflect on a speech that you gave mm-hmm. to the VS. But I guess we should set it up by pointing out you were one of the founding board members of the VS in 95.
Right.
So tell me, what did you want the VS to be when you were involved in setting it up in 95? And then we'll jump forward to now when you've just given the speech.
I think none of us knew exactly what it would be. I was, member 33. So I wasn't one of the I wouldn't say instigators of it.
But I'm right in thinking you were one of the founding board members, weren't you?
Yeah. So original board of directors, very excited about what it could do. And, you know, there had been a number of false starts of trying to create something like an honorary society like the VES or a trade organization. And it never came together. And a lot of that was through mistrust between facilities that people were going to get access or do things that would hurt each other rather than help each other. And by coming together as an honorary society, as opposed to a trade organization or something, it allowed us all to really focus on the upside and the good part of what we were all trying to create. But those early years was a lot of exploration also, I think, of figuring out really who are we, what are we trying to accomplish, how can we make an impact for the industry? It was a real interesting time.
So if we run the clock forward to September of this year, the Visual Effects Society honored you with the Founders Award, and this was presented at the annual general meeting. And mm-hmm. as part of that celebration of your contribution, you got to give a speech, which I understand was actually, I guess, almost wasn't version two, but this had actually even started with a speech you'd given before that. Where was the first one that you started to formulate these ideas for before we actually get to the – was it at NAB or SIGGRAPH, was it?
At SIGGRAPH this year. Right. So I got a call from Jeff Okun in May saying that the board had voted to give me the award, which is an incredible honor. And having been on the board and been to all the membership meetings, I knew what that meant, which was I get 10 or 15 minutes at the membership meeting to pontificate for a while. And John Erland, who got the first Founders Award, set the bar for all the rest of us. Instead of standing up and saying thank you and all happy things, he really expressed his opinions about the state of the industry. And for the six of us who have followed in his footsteps, that's kind of set the tone. Is it's like, here's your 15 minutes of fame to stand up in front of your peers and the people you admire in the industry and express your opinions about what's going on. So I knew that in May, and then I was invited to speak at the business symposium at SIGGRAPH. And I accepted that because it would be an interesting thing to do, but also I knew that I could do kind of a rough draft of the BES talk there. And so I used that, particularly the last 5 or 10 minutes of that talk, to essentially float out my idea that, you know, I love this industry and I'm really upset with the way people are treating it like it's about to die, rather than we're still giving birth to a very fascinating piece of industry and that what people are talking about are exclusively short-term, albeit very important, issues, and no one's looking forward anymore. And particularly with my experience with PDI and being able to survive 20 years because of the vision that we were all fighting to create and see come to fruit, I just got really frustrated that I don't see that vision anywhere anymore. I see everyone whining. That's a terrible word to use, but about the state of the industry. And again, justifiably, there's a lot of problems with it, but no one's looking at where it's going. And I think that there's incredible changes that are going to happen to this industry that if people aren't looking out there and trying to figure out where it's going, they're all going to get caught by surprise and there's not going to be an industry for anyone to compete in.
Well, I guess this is the greatest part about my job by far, is that I get to spend the next 20 minutes, whatever, talking to you about that very mm-hmm. issue, and I consider it a great honor to be able to do so. So I'm going to do that based on your talk, which has some big killer points in it, the first one of which I think is what you just said, which is your belief that the industry is being born now, not dying.
Right.
But I think it is important that we frame it that you're neither against the VES, having been a founding board member, nor have you had only the PDI experience, because you've obviously seen other companies and invested in other things. But I think one other important factor is you haven't walked away from the visual effects industry, though I gather you've perhaps broadened your focus a bit from just the visual effects industry. Is that mm-hmm. fair to say?
Yes, yes.
And so that's a sentiment that seems to come through in this talk, and I think one that I'd like to start with, which is this idea of this industry. I think we should just define what this industry is. Is it fair any longer to think of visual effects as sort of this industry in the way that the automotive industry is a kind of contained thing? Or is it that the very notion that you could only exist in the, quote, visual effects industry or just in the straight animation business is a, I guess, a bit of a dinosaur concept because of the way media is fragmenting, because of the way media is being distributed, and just the nature of the experience that somebody has, that if you were to set out now, you wouldn't even want to think of yourself in being confined in those terms? Or is it still valid to just be a visual effects company?
I would not think of myself in those terms at all. And again, that was some of my frustration with where I ended up at PDI and not being able to keep moving forward. And I think that in the last 10 years, the industry has not moved forward at all from the aspect of traditional media, movies, TV, animation, that everyone's doing the same thing. And in the meantime, the rest of the world has exploded. If you look at the changes in the game industry that have happened in just the last 10 years, it's been incredibly exciting. you know, both in the ability of what you can do on a high-end machine, but what you can do everywhere else also, you know, whether it's on mobile devices or just inside your browser. And that's still a very young industry. When you talk to people in the game industry about where the future is, it's pretty exciting. So I look at it from the standpoint of you have all this amazing technology. Well, it's you know, the group I'm with at Carnegie Mellon, the Entertainment Technology Center, it's perfect. It's entertainment and technology. Where do those meet? And they meet in a lot of places that aren't just movies and TV. And they meet in a lot of places that aren't just games also. There's all sorts of things you can do once you have the ability to create an image synthetically and tell stories and evoke emotions and impact people's lives with that.
Yeah, I would actually say that a point of view is often worth 10 IQ points. And that, and I wasn't original in saying that, I'm quoting someone, but even that notion of like what a computer game is, I mean, Steam, for example, is defining a whole new concept of what gaming is in terms of a distribution model, not in terms of a graphics engine. But let's work our way out then. So let's assume we're going to get to the wider market. Let's start, though, inside the narrower definition and work our way out. And to that end, you were quite adamant in this talk about the fact that basically, well, to quote you, there are no solutions, only opportunities. And you went on to say that you thought that a trade organization, I mean, if you think that's something that you really want to get into, go for it. But really, globalization is here to stay, deal with it. And more to the point, that there just is not enough work to go around. So in that concept of globalization, in that concept of you know, trade restrictions and arguing about subsidies and everything else, it just isn't enough work. Even though we are not in a state where visual effects are in decline in their use, or nor animation, for that matter. Talk to me about that in terms of is there no end in sight? Where are we? Like, do you think in terms of the amount of companies and countries entering this this space, is it?
It's easier and easier to get into the business. You know, when we started, you know, a computer animation program was called the C compiler, and you had to do everything from scratch. And now it's not that it's less expensive; it's that it's free. You can go get incredibly powerful tools that are open source now. So your barrier to entry is effectively zero, and it's, for thousands of dollars, you can be creating great stuff. And people will yell at me because it's not the equipment, it's not the technology, it's the people and the talent. And that's true. But if they don't have access to the technology, then you have a huge barrier to entry. But now everyone has access to that technology. On top of that, it's not hard to learn the basics of computer graphics anymore. There's all sorts of schools and universities that are ready to pull you in and teach you how to use it. There's incredible resources online to learn how to use the tools. So that barrier isn't there. To be creative, to have the skill and the artistic eye, yeah, there's a barrier there. But you know what? There's a lot of artists and people who are really talented. So there's just a huge opportunity for people to be able to jump in very easily. And we all know that filmmaking is really sexy. Everyone wants to work on a movie and get on the big screen and see their names and credits. And, you know, people will do anything to get their work on the big screen, which means that there's always going to be someone, talented, but someone who's willing to do the job cheap because they want the opportunity to break into the industry. That doesn't mean they're qualified to do it. It doesn't mean the end product will be any good, but it does put pressure on the industry. And pressure that the people who are qualified to do it need to deal with, because the buyers really don't care.
So I'll come back to this in a second, but some reaction to this talk. Scott Ross, for example, at another conference, and Jeff Huser, my partner, was there, quoted him as saying, in regards to your speech, Scott said, "Right now, today, when your kids are going to school, you have to pay the mortgage, you have to fly around the world and be gypsies, and it's just not right." And his point was that, to a certain extent, your view of this is all well and good with a kind of big, high overview, but down at the grassroots level, it's just really tough on the individual artists. Is that a point you even, I don't even strike me that's a point you disagree with. It's just that you think that somebody needs to do something to get to somewhere else. Is that fair?
Yeah, I actually agree with that completely. I think, by the way, that there should be a trade organization. I wasn't dissing that in the talk. I was just, basically, if you look at the structure of the talk, there's kind of this middle section. I did it as a three-act play, by the way.
I read your
and that's
breakdown,
That's part of the middle section, right? It's saying, yeah, here's all these problems, and there are things you can do to help address those problems. I think a trade organization could make a huge impact. I think there's challenges with it that people are still trying to figure out. I don't think a trade organization that's based in Los Angeles or is even California-centric is going to solve the problem. I think it really needs to be an international organization because it's an international community dealing with international issues and problems, and you have to get everyone involved in that. That makes it all that more difficult to do. And in the talk, what I said is, and that becomes a hurdle that keeps it from happening. And that's why I think what you need to do is just start small. And the only disagreement I have with Scott, and I guess I'm going to have to call him tomorrow and talk about this, is that I don't think you need a lot of money and stuff to get it going. I think you just get as many people who are willing to get onto the trade organization together, and you bite off something really small and doable. And it doesn't even matter what it is, but just something that you can get everyone on the same page, everyone to agree on, that creates a result. And that's going to give you a little bit of momentum. And once you have that, and once you've proven that, not a dozen companies with $100,000 each, but five companies with a little bit of money can get together and decide on something and agree on it and make it a policy that they're going to abide by, I think you'll get other people who are willing to step up and help that. And you can work your way up to, having a big budget where you can hire lawyers to go out and lobby for you or whatever else you need to do.
You did say that 20 years from now, outsourcing, tax incentives, global, all these issues, basically none of this is going to matter, like, because 20 years from now, the business isn't going to be the same.
Right.
So there is an overtone that you can do something with trade organizations and it's good to do them, but they're not the solution.
Right. I think, they're the solution to surviving until you get there.
Right.
in maybe as soon as 10 years, but certainly within 20 years. At the same time, everyone could go out of business tomorrow, and that doesn't mean there isn't a visual effects industry. It'll just be different people, or in fact, it'll be the same people under different shingles.
Because when you started, it was literally like the Wild West. Companies were coming and going and spending huge amounts of money, and it looked really hard to – when you started PDI, it looked really hard to have a sustainable business model because it just didn't look like it was going to add up, and yet
– Well, there weren't that many people coming and going. There were a handful of companies that were pretty stable until, 1984, 1985, when the whole – one of the first crashes happened, the whole omnibus event that, so that was a combination of omnibus in Canada, which there's a lot of questionable financial dealings behind what that was really about. There was Digital Productions in Accra, which, as you discussed with Richard, was unsustainable, having tens of millions of dollars worth of computer equipment. Bob Abel did brilliant, beautiful work. And for whatever reasons, on the business side, that wasn't sustainable. And then you mash them all together and you have a huge implosion. There were a couple other companies that went out of business at the same time. And I think it was just the realities of having to shift to actually be a business that's sustainable kind of kicked into gear at that point, because it became a real business. But out of that came companies that were sustainable. I mentioned Rhythm and Hughes in the talk, and those guys have sustained and done a fantastic job.
Absolutely. So in your talk, you said a section in there, you're discussing for right now, therefore, like just still inside our industry in that narrow definition, I think you said basically go big or go home or go mobile, which again, you said you didn't think was sustainable and long term. So talk to us about what you mean about go big or go home. Because it felt like you were still talking about the sort of narrower definition of visual effects per se, and that it was important. In fact, I think you made the point that you were sort of surprised or astonished that people still go to the movies.
Yeah, yes. that was all part of building up the, you know, the analogy with the orchestras, but really that the attitude about entertainment is my audience is being eroded away by all these other opportunities that come along. And so in order to compete with that, I'd have to be larger and louder and to garner the attention. And you certainly, if you look at films, all the big blockbusters, the tentpole pictures are all big, you know, in size, in budget, in complexity. They're loud visually and audibly, and they're making a lot of noise. And it's trying to give you, you know, we're going to give you an experience you just can't get any other way, which I get and I understand why they're doing that. But there's only so big and so loud you can go. And, you know, we're seeing it's, you know, with speeding up frame rates now. It's like, okay, we're going to try and improve it once again and give them something they can't get any other way. But the reality is we can get a lot of that at home. I believe movie theaters will be around for a long time. You know, television didn't put them out of business. They didn't put radio out of business. I think there's a lot of things that draw us into movie theaters, but it doesn't have to be just it's bigger and louder than anything else I can see. So that comment there was really looking at the trend of the way all this stuff evolves is to be able to attract attention to itself.
So let's now expand our definition out, this idea that I no longer want to think of our industry, in inverted commas, as just sort of strictly a visual effects industry doing feature films. And there's the net, which is obviously a huge aspect of it. And then related to the net, there's the mobile side of things. And then there's just the whole idea of not having a passive experience, which is what I'm going to put games as the put a principal category of. But again, right, as we've already discussed, that's pretty loose. In a global world with this is going on, is it still possible to disrupt without being sort of the company that has the Google-esque funds behind you? Because it is the reality that there's like a small handful of big game companies that make most of the money in games. There's a small handful of internet companies that pull most of the advertising on the internet. And there's a small handful of studios that make most of the Hollywood blockbusters. Mm-hmm. I mean, is the market room, is there enough flexibility to be able to sort of beat the system and build up?
Yeah, there's always that opportunity. I mean, if you look online, you know, big company Zynga, how long has Zynga been around? I mean, it's been a single digit number of years, right? And look at the impact Facebook has made. And that's been, how old are they now? Maybe 10 years old. I think there's always opportunities for people to disrupt if you have a great idea and a great approach.
And that's what you think is lacking at the moment. You just don't think that there's a vision,
Yeah. So let's just look at the technology of computer graphics and what it enables you to do. So what we're all using it for now is to replicate reality. Certainly in every live action film, it's, you know, in order for it to integrate in there, it's got to look absolutely real. So we're creating things that don't exist in our world, perhaps, you know, whether it's aliens or different environments or any of that, or, you know, we are trying to create stuff that does exist in our world, but just do it cheaper. But we're using computers to create something that arguably could be done a million other ways in live action. Or is it even necessary to do that at all? It's fun, it's exciting, but, you know, do I really have to do it? So the computer right now is being used just to replicate reality. You get into animated films and it's like, okay, my reality can be more fantasy related, but it's still a real traditional kind of storytelling. But what the computer brings you is the ability to not have to do that as a linear story. And that's where video games are really, you know, the leading edge right now. It's saying, okay, we have this computer, can generate these beautiful images And by the way, it can do it in real time, which means that I don't have to define ahead of time exactly my story. And the power of using a computer rather than straight live action, the primary thing the computer gives you that live action doesn't is the ability to manipulate it in real time. So you can't go give me a live action experience other than as a play where I in the audience can interact with it. But I can't go get a live action experience that I get to interact with that isn't just my normal life. Using traditional technologies, the computer allows me to create those environments and put you into that environment and have that environment interact with you. And that's where I see the dead end for computer graphics in the traditional linear media. It's like, well, we could always tell linear stories and now we can do them better and fancier and neater, but so what? What's the computer bringing you that you couldn't really do before?
And
it's
so
just, it's just a different look.
And so your advice to, I presume, someone at an individual level or at a company level is broaden your horizons and find, I think you described it as an impossible problem to try and solve. Because that seems to me a real linchpin of your talk, which is it's not just a vision, which is, you know, a vision can be, I want to be, you know, very successful in this industry. But it was this idea of an impossible problem trying to be solved. Because up until the point you made a fully animated feature, there was a really clear period then when we all knew that the goal was making a fully animated feature film. I mean, it was like so obviously the problem to be solved,
right.
And it was just really hard to get there. And I guess there are a couple of those still, like fully photoreal actors that are actually computer generated as opposed to just sort of modifications. And so there are some technical things still in that you could define, but we seem to be missing those kind of really tangible and yet at the moment unreachable targets or problems to be solved.
Yeah. So to me, let's take that human actor. To me, that just is incredibly boring to me. And we were asked from early days of PDI, you know, when are you going to be able to do Marilyn Monroe, you know, bring her back to life? And it's like, I really don't care. She's dead. Everyone knows she's dead, you know? And if we do her, why is that any different at all than someone who's a really good Marilyn Monroe impersonator? It brings you nothing other than a bunch of techno lust. It's meaningless to me. Now, what you could do if you have that and it's computer generated is suddenly now I can interact with her. Now that's something that's interesting, right? And something that you can't bring to the masses. So it's that interaction that's the magical part, not the fact that you can just do a human with a computer.
Okay, but I guess I was defining that as a goal, because
okay.
I was looking for what those problems might be. So I take your point, and it's well made that yes, you may not be interested in just making a synthetic person, but it's one of the few obvious goals that somebody can say, well, we can't do that right now. We should try and solve that problem. But you want those sort of very tangible targets outside the realm of just sort of a graphics problem.
I'll throw a few at you. If you want just raw technology, how about like really real holograms? Like, we always see in the science fiction movies, right? A three-dimensional thing that can float in front of you in space can't happen now. I don't, you know, there's interesting technology in the labs that's getting close to it, but not possible at all. But more interesting to me personally. So, and this is the part where I don't want to give anyone what their vision should be, but I know what mine would be.
Yeah.
So I'm really enamored with augmented reality and the idea that in the future we're all going to be wearing a much cooler version of Google Glass than what you see in the videos that enables you to lay realistic images on top of the reality that we're already experiencing, right? So I can just put on a pair of lightweight glasses and boom, you know, stuff is not virtual reality where I'm in a completely different world, but augmented reality where stuff is coexisting, you know, not real stuff is coexisting in my real world. And the pieces of that technology all exist, right? And most of it is because of what we've done in the visual effects industry. So I know how to actually drop a character or an item into a three-dimensional environment in a way that makes it look like it belongs there. I know how to do head tracking. I know how to do stereoscopy, all that stuff. But the technology doesn't exist yet to where I can actually do that in a pair of glasses that's floating on my face. But if I were running an animation company, that's what I would be building for is, hey, I think 20 years from now, we're all going to be walking around with those glasses every place. And I would be trying to figure out how can I take characters that I develop, put them into your world and have them interact with you in meaningful and interesting ways. So that gives you, okay, now I got to figure out AI. How are my characters interacting in your world? I have to figure out all sorts of interesting input with voice, with gesture, all that stuff. I have to figure out how to actually integrate characters into live action in real time. I have to figure out how to make characters that are much more intelligent than anything we have today. On and on and on. I mean, it's a whole pile of things that have to be created. But if you can develop all those pieces of technology, then you're going to be in a pretty unique, interesting position. And all of those, by the way, there are things you can do today that push those, just like we were doing, flying logos as a lead up to being able to do a fully computer animated film. It's like you can do mobile apps that do some of that stuff with augmented reality. You can do video games that bring characters to life and mean that characters have to interact with them. It goes on and on. So there are business opportunities for you to start developing all those pieces of technology that you're going to need. So I would be, doing augmented reality apps. I would be doing games. I'd be looking for all the opportunities where I can take my expertise in being able to create computer generated characters. But now how can I make them think and act on their own? How can I integrate them into your life outside of just straight linear media?
And you think that's going to come from a startup in someone's garage that's sort of about to happen or yet to happen? Or do you think that's going to fall out of big companies, or it doesn't matter which it is?
Well, it doesn't matter. I think it's going to come out of a startup, though, because the big companies have too much vested in old stuff. I mean, we know it's not going to come out of an entertainment company because they're spending all their energy trying to be louder and bigger than they were before. Maybe it comes out of a place like Google with Glass, but they're really, they're not looking at characters. They're looking at information and how to present information. And, I would be looking more at entertaining people or interacting with people. Maybe it comes out of a game company. I don't think it'll come out of a big game company. I think it'll come out of a small company. I think someone's going to, have all the pieces and put them together in a really interesting way.
One of the areas that interests me at the moment that I think is sort of related to what you're talking about, though, I guess a new aspect we haven't explicitly discussed, you've been talking about this idea of interacting and to a certain extent that interaction falls in that gaming area. But it strikes me that one of the things that isn't focused on an enormous amount, though, is very much gathering momentum on the sidelines, is actually understanding, I'm going to call it storytelling in games, but it's otherwise known as gamification or the issues or motivations of games, because it seems to me that we've sort of studied hard in the film industry to understand a three-act structure, a narrative arc, a quest for a character, a lot of those things that work in a linear space. And we don't have quite as many discussions outside the gaming industry on what it takes to have a leveled base experience, to have an environment that you can explore freely and that doesn't have a directed path, to do things other than sort of obvious puzzle type stuff. And
right. And
that's something that I think is invaluable for the entertainment visual effects side to learn from the gaming industry rather than just go after their real-time gaming engines.
Right.
And to that end, I guess, yeah, I was just sort of wondering, there's a VC who I heard talk recently, and he said that no company that would submit a VC submission to him today that didn't have some aspect of gameplay or gamification in it he just wouldn't fund them because basically no one under the age of like 20-something, I think he said, grew up in a world that didn't exist in levels. And so to work without that is to naively assume, in the way that we would have said that, I guess, for our generation around music videos and short form. Do you think there is a change in, because of these people being brought up in a culture that's only ever known a world that's had extensive gaming, in just sort of that we haven't really caught up with because the older people that run the bigger media companies just never experienced that in their youth?
Yeah, possibly. You know, I don't know that we all have to level up every time we read a book. But, you know, I think that kind of reward culture is certainly something that exists with the younger generation. Yeah, I'm not sure quite where to go with that.
I guess I'm curious because when we see people trying to expand outside the entertainment industry, and for example, they look to games, I hear more times than not they're interested in using real-time gaming engines to do things faster or to preview stuff or to do stuff. I seldom hear them wanting to raid the gaming industry for their knowledge of the understanding of what motivates someone to spend hundreds of hours in front of a game.
Oh,
which I think is, you know, if you could translate that into watching hundreds of hours of my TV show, would be quite valuable. But that isn't what they seem to want to mine. And I was trying to use that as an example that this idea that, you know, what to expand into isn't as obvious as what we do now, but with somebody else's new technology.
Right.
I think it's, I don't want to sound like I'm telling you anything because obviously my opinion is, but I was curious from your point of view whether there's enough scope in people's understanding what it means to expand outside the straight visual effects sector, because it just feels like it's, well, we're going to do what we do now, but with somebody else's tech, more than let's rethink this entire problem.
Right, right. And I think it comes back to just figuring out, you know, really, I mean, to me, it's what are the core things that you're interested in? So, I mean, to talk about the gamification side of it, that term to me just means that it's really about getting people into a reward cycle, you know, getting them to behave a certain way. You give them a reward and that makes them behave that way some more. You know, that's a simplification of the way that I've seen it typically used. But I see where you're coming from about taking advantage of those other technologies and directions in ways that aren't obvious. And I agree with you completely. I think, you know, for me about the whole vision topic, it's figuring out, you know, what excites you specifically, that's going to motivate you to go do interesting stuff. And, you know, it's interesting in Silicon Valley, we live in the middle of startup land here. And there's a lot of people who decide they want to do a startup and they really don't care what it is. It's just the idea of being a part of the startup culture. And that's successful for a lot of people. To me, though, it's the people that I'm interested in talking to and that motivate me are the ones who say, well, I'm doing a startup because I have this really amazing idea or vision of where I want to see things happen. There's stuff that I just wake up in the morning and I got to think about it and got to attack those problems. And that to me is really motivating. And it's so with this technology, it's what is it that excites you about all of the technologies we have for visual effects? Is it really sitting in front of a compositing machine and making pictures come together? If it is, then, you know, you kind of know what your industry is going to, or what your job is going to be for the near term, at least. But if it's really, how can I take this cool technology and I know how to make pictures with it, but I really want to get those pictures embedded into people's lives in really cool ways. I want to tell stories in ways that people can't tell those stories today. And how am I going to use the technology to enable me to do that more? And that's the stuff that I find really exciting. And why, when I was giving the talk, it's like, I can't tell you what you need to do in the future because I don't know what's really exciting to you. Because it's not my vision. My vision is really, if I want to start a company and you know, get people to follow me to go create that, then my vision is really important. But, you know, I'm not going to tell you what, and I'm going to find other people basically who are that excited about what I'm I'm excited about, and we'll go do that.
Absolutely. You weren't trying to give a prescription for the six steps the industry needed to do to get to the other side, other than you wanted the industry, it sounded like, to come up with some place it wanted to be, so at least it could work out the direction in which to go in.
Yeah.
So I need to ask you, therefore, are you seeing those people? I mean, this is the only part of the speech that I didn't really get that I wanted, which was in your everyday kind of experiences in Silicon Valley, in the kind of like the thick of tech and entertainment, you know, are you seeing these people? Are there just a few of them, or is it really a wasteland and kind of it's not happening?
Seeing which people?
The people that have got that fire, be them at startup level or whatever, to define a problem, to define a vision and go there. I mean, you didn't obviously base your talk on examples, but are there examples of people that you see that are actually doing this today, or do you sort of...
There's a lot of people with fire and interest and great ideas that are out there, but none of them, I think, that are really leveraging off of the visual effects and computer animation industry. I mean, most of the people that I see who are interested in doing games are, you know, as an example, aren't looking very far out even with games. They're, hey, mobile's really big and, you know, tablets are cool and you know, how can we leverage onto that? And but they're still not looking out far even for the games industry. So it's frustrating. And I haven't seen anyone in the visual effects industry who's really got a long-term vision of where they want to go with their ideas and their techniques that's compelling. And that's what's so disappointing to me, because it's brilliant, creative people developing and using these tools. And everyone seems to be very myopic about how they can apply those tools. And I think there's... It's just so early in the phase. I mean, the whole industry has been around, you know, a few decades, and we've got a long, long way to go. And the acceleration of computer technology is not slowing down. You know, that Moore's law, despite the fact we're running into some limitations in physics, hey, that stuff, we've run into those walls before, and someone figures out a different way around it. And stuff's going to keep getting faster and faster. And I, you know, 20 years from now, the computer on your desk, well, you won't have a computer on your desk. Whatever computers are around you are going to be a million times more powerful than the ones that are around you now. So what are you doing with that? It's not word processing. It's not spreadsheets. You don't need a million times more power to do that. It's going to all be spent in the user interface and the way that the visuals are presented to you, and the way that you're interacting with it, and the way it's finding information and giving it back to you. It's basically all in the UI part of it. Because that's the part we care about. So what are you going to do with that? How are you going to use that? You know, compositing a film and making all that stuff 20 years from now is just not going to be that difficult. If you think it feels like a commodity now, man, it's going to be even more of a commodity later. And I was really careful, because I did use commodity in the talk, and people are super sensitive to that, understandably, because no one wants to think they're a commodity. But I said in there, you know, you may not think you're a commodity, but a client sees no differentiation between you and everyone else, then you are a commodity.
Well, I was sorry to not be there to hear your speech firsthand, but with your permission, we'll put a link to the talk on our site. And I found it to be absolutely brilliant, and I was incredibly motivated when I heard it. And then obviously the chance to talk to you was too good to pass up. It's been a great pleasure having a chance to talk to you. I can't thank you enough for taking time.
Thanks, Mike. My pleasure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I think Carl's very inspirational and very powerful. Getting people active and involved in helping our industry really get through some times that I think we can all agree are pretty devastating. And as much as there's such a growing need for visual effects, the industry just needs much more power and authority. I mean, we produce these visual effects and we create these amazing works, but yet we are not compensated. We are not rewarded. The business is living on scraps and really fighting over very thin margins, and so many things need to change, and we need to build that brighter future for ourselves. Anyway, before we close out, I'd like to thank our FX Guide Insider members who support the site through their contributions. As a thanks for donations made as part of the FX Insider program, we give you exclusive access to additional content, things like member-only articles, additional effects breakdowns, and more. Details are at fxguide.com and click the FX Insider tab. In addition to this FX podcast, which you've been listening to, we do two other regular audio podcasts. The first one is the VFX Show, which reviews visual effects and current releases, as well as classic films. And then the RC podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. If you enjoyed this podcast, we'd also recommend our HD video podcast, FX Guide TV. And don't forget, we have a sister site, fxphd.com, that offers extensive online visual effects training. Well, that'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.